All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuckineers? What the fucksters? What the fuckadelics? What the fucknicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. Wow, did I just say my name weird? I'm Mark Maron. This is my show, WTF. Welcome to it. How are you? Everybody okay? Thanks for all the excited feedback about the James Franco episode. Seems that people really dug it. It was good. Nice long one. Dug in. Did a lot of listening. I've been doing a lot of listening lately. More listening than I'm generally known for. Usually I'm known for listening and interjecting. And now I'm just experimenting with just listening. We should all do some listening. Anyway, there's actually a sign in my garage that says, what people need is a good listening to. Someone sent that to me. It was a gift. I took it as a gift and as a not a passive aggressive thing. Superfan Amy years ago, I think, sent that to me. I think it was her. But yeah, so that's just up there. And now I'm referring to it because at some point I'm going to have to dismantle this shrine of listening here at the garage, but not soon. Doesn't seem like it's going to be soon. I'm here now. I'm here in it. I'm doing the show. Today on the show, I'm going to talk to my old friend Judd Apatow. He's got a special. And Loudon Wainwright, who also Judd has used in movies. They're not together. Two different talks. But that's what's ahead. That's what's ahead for you. But first, Europe. Hello, Europe. I'm coming to see you this spring, Europe. Monday, April 16th in London, England. Thursday, April 19th in Stockholm, Sweden. Sunday, April 22nd in Oslo, Norway. Monday, April 23rd in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And Thursday, April 26th in Dublin, Ireland. It's my few parts of the world tour. Go to WTFpod.com and check out the tour page to get venue and ticket information. All right? I'm coming for a little while. That is the tour I planned. I want to go see some places. I want to see the world before it burns. I'd like to see some parts of the world before they're gone. I'd like to get out and enjoy my life now that I've worked so hard all these years before it goes away. See, I'm trying to be, those two tones, that's the upbeat, and then I just undercut it with the terrified. Oh my God. Terrified, but not running. Like, oh no, unbelievable. But yeah. So it's been an interesting week. I haven't talked to you since last week, but I think I recorded that before most of California was on fire and before I was nominated for a Critics' Choice Award. See how it comes, the yin and the yang. Hey, is that fire going to consume my new house? I don't know. I don't know if it is. It's time to spend some time watching fire apps, watching fire maps, watching for when the fire comes. I feel horrible for people who lost property, lost pets, lost homes, not in that order necessarily, whose lives were compromised by these fires. But there are fires all over fucking California. And it's terrifying because the brain just seeks to make there's always been fires, right? Not like this. Just like, I don't know, a fire might break out in the fucking garage in 3 minutes. It's just like spontaneous fires. But most of the people I know up north and around people I come in contact with at work, their homes are okay. But again, I hope everything's okay out there for everyone. I feel bad for people that got compromised by these fires. But it's not, this can't, is it? Is this normal now? Like, I've always been kind of nervous about California in general. I want to run, man. But then it's like nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. And I believe there are some places to run and there are a few places to hide. But I dug in. I got a new place. And I guess if it's going to go down, it's going to go down. But I've actually done jokes about this, about these fires and about you years ago. It's just crazy. I went out and Sarah, the painter, got some emergency kits. We got that. I guess I'm going to have to get a generator. One way or the other, you better be preparing for the end of something. And I'm not saying that in a tone of terror or existential despair. It's a practical term. Prepare for the end. All right? On the other side of the fires, I was nominated for a Critics' Choice Award. Yeah, I'm excited. A Critics' Choice nomination. Look, folks, for me, I didn't anticipate being nominated for anything ever. You know, I thought the one shot we had was a Peabody, but they poo-pooed it. The Peabody's poo-pooed us, I guess. I thought that was the one that would have been the one possible, the one window of opportunity to get any accolades. I certainly didn't anticipate getting any accolades for acting or for anything. For stand-up, I don't know. I'm not being falsely humble. I just, like, looking at my life, it just was not part of any of the possibilities. But so the Critics' Choice Award is a welcomed excitement, and I am grateful for it, and I'm excited about it. And GLOW, the show, got several. Alison Brie got one. Betty Gilpin got a nomination. I think the show got a nomination. So everybody on set was excited, and we needed that excitement over the last few days because we were shooting the show up in Pomona on a set that, God, I don't want to spoil anything. Would it spoil anything? Maybe it'll provide suspense. We were on a hospital set in Pomona for 2 days, 12-hour shoots running well into the evening, 1 or 2 in the morning. So it was nice to have the extra added excitement of knowing that the show is getting this recognition. It was fun times. I'm trying, you know, on a day-to-day basis, for whatever reason, I experience a great deal of dread and terror in my head. And I know many of you know this, and I'm not experiencing it right now, but I actually had a moment on set the other night where it's like, look, I wait around a long time to do 3 lines. On Friday night, we had shot all day. We were there from like 12 to 1 in the morning. And I did one scene in the morning, which was a fun scene. No lines, but it was fun. It was me and Allison and Betty and Chris Lowell. And then pretty much I waited around like 8 hours, about 8 hours. And they did everyone's coverage. All the women were there, you know, all 13, 14 of them. And we covered everything except my point, you know, my coverage with where the camera's on me. It was the last shot of the night, of a 12 and a half hour night at 1 in the morning. And for some reason, instead of feeling like, well, fuck, man, what kind of gig is this? What is all this waiting around, this acting business? I just locked in and I'm like, make it a good few minutes, man. This is what you wait for. This is what acting is. Enjoy this minute and a half and just, you know, act the shit out of it. I was doing a beat with all of them. I had a beat with Betty, who's great, great actress. And we just had the moment and it felt very rewarding. That's a step in the right direction. It wasn't like, man, was that worth waiting for? I'm trying to tell you that I turned a corner and I've grown to appreciate, hey, if this is the window, if this is the moment, if this is where I get to act on this episode, if these 2 lines are where it's at for the day, then lean in, man. And I guess that's pretty good advice for anybody. Like, if you have those moments where you got to show up and do your job, you know, fully focused, you know, even if it's only for a half an hour that it's expected out of you, and you spend the other 12 hours, you know, looking at a computer or pretending to work, make the best out of that. Make the best out of that half hour. Make the best out of that 5 minutes, man, because it's all burning. Everything is on fire. Oh, my God. So Judd came by because he's got a special. Judd Apatow, The Return, premieres tomorrow, December 12th on Netflix, and we got into it. It's always good to see Judd. It's always good to have a chat, and it always ends up longer than we think, and it always ends up pretty engaged because, you know, we do what we do. So this is me hanging out with Judd Apatow for a bit. That's the thing about your special. Let's start there. Technique-wise, you bold motherfucker, yep, used a wireless. There was no aversion to using a fucking wireless.
At least I didn't go with the Janet Jackson, you know, McDonald's, yeah, wireless.
No, you can't do that. No, no, no. Of course not. But I don't trust wireless mics. I'm like some weird old timey guy. Like, if I don't know that it's connected to something, and they always seem bulky and they don't slide, yes, in and out properly, and you just went, yeah, ahead and used it.
Well, I have a different issue, which is I am not that professional as a comedian, and I will constantly trip over the cord.
So you knew that. You're like, I prefer not to have more mess up here than necessary.
I literally find myself at the Comedy Store tripping over the cord so often that when they said we have a cordless, I was like, yes, thank you.
Didn't even think about it. So I watched you work on a lot of the material for months and months. And then I didn't know, like, a third of it. Where were we hiding that stuff? Did you just pull it out that night?
Well, what's interesting is, you know, when you do the improv and the Comedy Store, there's so much material that just doesn't work there.
Uh-huh.
You know, longer stories, yeah. things that take time when you need people to pay more attention.
So, right.
You know, there was always a larger hunks that worked in theaters or places where people were paying
more
attention.
Oh, so you were working that stuff out elsewhere.
Yeah, certain bits where I thought, well, this is an 11-minute
poem
bit. Yes, the poem bit. I read a poem that I wrote when I was 14 when my parents were getting divorced, which I stumbled onto. And it's so sad, but makes me laugh so much.
I wrote poems in exactly the same cadence, that there was a weird kind of naive social importance
yes.
to what you're saying.
And the Dr. Seuss rhyme scheme.
Yeah, but you had a little free verse there. It wasn't all Dr. Seussy.
What I found interesting about finding this poem, one is that the poem is basically saying, I'm in enormous amount of pain, but maybe this pain will one day make me a good comedian. And I wrote that when I was 14. That's basically what the poem is about.
You already knew.
But, you know, when I was a kid, I had this sense that I was supposed to be good at certain things if I wanted to be in comedy.
Yeah.
And so... And I tried everything. I tried juggling pins. I tried to write sketches. I just took a quick pop at everything.
What were the other ones? Guitar playing?
Guitar playing I was terrible at. You know,
that you went with the juggling. Did you figure out how to get the balls in the air?
I could juggle the pins. Then I bought the fire pins
that you could light on
fire. And then never worked up the courage to light them.
And that's why it took you so long to make a special.
Exactly. I was so afraid. And then one day I wrote a poem, and it's interesting. It's a real window into how my brain works, or worked at the time. But I find the most interesting part is I never wrote a poem again.
Right.
So I wrote this long poem, and then in my head I must have thought, yeah, you're not good at this.
Yeah.
And stopped, which is a metaphor for my stand-up career. You know, my brain wants to shut it down.
But oddly... because I wrote poetry in college and I took it seriously at some point, even after high school, even after my big Ginsbergian assault on the world we live in at 14. I think that writing comedy is poems. I think that jokes are poetic. There's rhythm. There's a turn of phrase. There's
yes.
a lot of things that are very poetic elements.
Yeah, I agree. Every once in a while when something's worded perfectly, it feels a little poetic. This is the one that is so truthful, but I was proud of this thought, and it's so simple, but I talk about how my 15-year-old just seems so unhappy to be in the house sometimes with me and my wife.
Right.
And I say, you know, when you have four people, it is a family. When it is three, it is a child observing a weird couple. That's as close as I get to poetry. It just says it all. It's like a haiku.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Arguably, I think that you committed your life to poetry. That's the way I'm going to look at it.
I like it.
I mean, I would have liked to have been a poet, but where do you really go with that? You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's like maybe you got a couple books that nine people read and you teach somewhere. That's the best that you could hope for.
Yeah, that always leads to the debate. How many people do you need to watch your stuff or like your stuff?
Well, you know the answer to that.
I need it to work in China. I need it to work in Russia. That's the funny thing in the business now is everything about the business is like, will things work overseas? And you get in these meetings where there's a subtle subtext, which is like, you know, is there anything you could chuck in it, like an actress from another country that might bring in the Spanish crowd? And then when you try it, it never works. You always bomb in the country of the foreigner you put in.
You've done that?
Well, just in the sense that sometimes we work with people from other countries because we love them, not to do it for a marketing reason, but I've never felt a bump in that country because I had the Russian guy in a few scenes. But they do want you to think that way, and they also are trying to reach people that don't understand verbal humor.
Yeah.
So there's also this feeling generally that... You know, movies work best when you're blowing up shit.
Blowing up shit or just like very broad physical comedy or expressions?
Yes. You think, I don't know how to reach people in other countries. And every once in a while, a movie blows up around the world. You have no idea why. We made this movie called Begin Again.
Yeah.
And it was Mark Ruffalo movie that John Carney, the guy who made Once, made.
Yeah.
And it did okay in the United States. In South Korea.
Yeah.
Makes $25 million.
That movie.
It's gigantic in one country on earth. South Korea loves Keira Knightley in a musical. And we don't know why. You can't try to appeal because you'll never figure it out.
You can't manufacture lightning in a bottle. It just happened.
There was no part of the process where I thought South Korea's going to love this.
This is going to kill there. We got an ace in the hole in South Korea. So I like that the special and that, you know, your whole approach to stand up, given your 20-year hiatus, was
it? It was 22 years.
A 22-year hiatus from when you did the Young Comedian special, 92. And then you go on, you make $1 billion, you make a lot of movies, TV shows, you write jokes for other comics. And now finally you feel confident enough to get back to what you started out doing. But the reason I bring it up is because I thought you were very humble and you had a lot of humility around the approach. You didn't come in swaggering. You were sort of like, I know where I'm at. I'm a strong feature at this point.
I always say that the only show since I started pursuing stand-up aggressively in 2014 where I really felt like I did badly and got nervous was one night at the Comedy Cellar when you walked in the room.
Stop it. Come on.
I got really self-conscious and I had just started, maybe I had been doing it a few months again.
Me?
And you walked in the room and on stage, all I thought was, Marin knows this sucks. And I didn't feel that way with, you know, Ray Romano watching or anybody watching. Dice Clay was watching me one night. For some reason, I felt so connected to you that the voice in my head that's telling me that I suck is also Mark Maron's voice. So when I finally was doing well enough that you would indicate to me, like, it's going good, you got some good stuff, I really relaxed generally.
Just recently?
Just recently, you'd be like, stuff's looking good. Or the best compliment is when you hear from someone else, like, Maron said you got some good shit. I'm like, oh, thank God. Or you're like, Attell said you're funny now.
Oh, okay. You got one of those?
Oh, that was a big one.
That's a huge one.
The Attell likes your stuff.
That's the one we all want.
Exactly.
Is for him to say anything about you.
But when I started doing it again, it's so funny because I was so into stand-up from the time I was 17 to 24, but really from the time I was 10 to 24, that when I stopped, I was pretty burnt out at just doing 7 days a week of nothing but thinking about jokes, writing jokes, watching comedians. So I didn't even look at comics for a decade. And only maybe around 2010, 11, did I go, what's everybody doing? I didn't even go to the improv for 15 years, probably.
Right. Really?
Even to watch. So I didn't even. And then I started feeling like, even as a comedy producer, I should know what's happening.
Yeah, but that sounds like somebody who, like, you know, quit something like that was hurting them, but they had no control. It's like an addiction. Like, I can never go back to where that's happening.
I just lost interest in
really?
It. Not it wasn't anger. I felt just bored of watching it, and then slowly, I'm trying to think who was.
I think that's a grown up thing.
Who was the comedian that got me excited again? I started watching Hannibal a little bit.
Yeah.
And he was making me laugh. I think watching, there was a few people that I thought, wow, like Maria Bamford.
I
remember hearing her on your show.
Yeah.
You drove somewhere with her.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And I was really taken by that.
Oh, yeah. And you'd not seen her before that?
No.
Oh, man.
And then I started looking that up. And then I realized, oh, there's some amazing people.
Right.
Who are a lot better than the people when I started.
And different. You know, I mean, sure, there's always some slouches around.
Yes.
But, you know, there were some great guys then, too, when we started or, like, whenever that was. 92, you said the Young Comedian special was?
Yes.
And so I started in 89, I think, officially, you know, making money.
Yeah.
Probably 87, 88 doing it. But there were good people around, but there was, you know, the remnants of the road of that first wave. Yeah. And there were a lot of those kind of, you know, mid-level headliners with the, you know, rap closers or somersaults. But there was always, like, you know, there were
some people in the generation before us where you're like, well, that was really unique. Those guys are really sort of doing something completely different. And there's a lot of them around now.
I mean, back then it really was Hicks. Yeah. You go see Bill Hicks.
For that thing. He was singular in that. Yes. Stephen Wright was singular in that.
Yes.
In his thing.
Goldthwaite.
Yeah.
When you would go see him in the late 80s. And of course, Kinison, who to this day, I've never seen anyone more exciting to watch.
Just menacing.
Just to see.
Electric.
To see Kinison before the crowd knew who he was the most exciting comedy you've ever seen. And it really can't be recaptured. Like people walking in a room not knowing this guy's coming and not knowing the joke, the point of view, and he starts screaming at them.
Yeah.
The place would erupt. Half the place would walk out.
Yeah.
And there's no one like that now.
It's just an exciting panic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, I actually, for some reason, on the random thing on my iPod in the car, the album went on. I have, like, that first album, Hotter Than Hell, or Louder Than Hell, it's not on CD, so someone's got to rip it. And someone ripped it at some point and gave it to me. And I listened to the whole thing through, and I've always been a guy that listens to that once a year. And I had experiences with him. And then, like, this was the first time where I was sort of like, man, that was really kind of wrong-minded and shitty, that one.
Well, it's all so awful.
Yeah.
I remember laughing.
I mean, I knew it was, but like, I felt the slight offense for the first time. So, like, you know, he was definitely a monster, but the intensity and the balls of it all, you don't see that much.
It felt like, I guess, looking back, if you were to try to define the Sam Kinison character, it would be the world has broken him.
Yes,
and so in a way,
and the world will pay.
And so you enjoyed it from that point of view, that he was, it was a person in meltdown. So his opinions, which were so wrong at times, you never felt like the joke was he believes it. You felt like this is what happens when you get broken.
Cautionary tale.
Yes. You just completely lose your mind and start screaming at starving people to go to the food.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense at all.
Punching way down.
Yes.
Punching as down as you can punch.
Exactly. He's so because I always took it like it's the frustration that life is unkind that makes you go, what are we going to do? I don't know. Go to the fucking food.
Yeah. Right.
But it doesn't make any sense at all.
That way he captures that whole thing with where it's like, you know, you're sitting there eating what you pulled together. Like he phrased it like, he was just sitting in front of the television set with some shitty dinner that he pulled together for himself. And there's a starving guy on TV, a starving kid.
Yeah.
And it just infuriated him.
And isn't that just a cover for an inability to feel sadness? That you do feel so sad that you just start screaming nonsense because you can't go to that vulnerable place that just wants to cry about that kid.
Yeah, you're broke. Your heart broke and now it's exploding.
Yes.
All over everybody.
Unless we're just totally wrong and he was just a
monster. Yeah. Definitely there was some of that. But okay, but like what I was saying though, like I was impressed and I entered the Apatow return, you know, seeing you around as, you know, like I was, not that I needed to defend you, but I'm like, wait, people were surprised. I'm like, he was writing jokes for some of our favorite comics when he was a child. What, you think he's going to have a hard time putting together an act? You know, I mean, did you think, as a joke writer, and you drew from your life, you know, very frankly, that you were going to have a hard time putting together an act?
I think what it is that I didn't think about it too much. I just slowly slid into it.
Yeah.
I think what helped me a lot in doing it again.
Yeah.
One was I didn't need to do it to pay my rent.
Right.
And I didn't need to beg for spots. So I was very lucky that I had enough recognition that clubs would put me up as a freak show anyway. At least in the beginning.
But you're not like Steve-O. I mean, you're Judd Apatow. You're like...
But just there was something amusing about seeing me attempt to do it.
Yeah.
The other thing that helped me a lot is I didn't know who any of the comics were. So when I started going up at the Cellar, I didn't know almost anybody. So I didn't have the fear of everybody because at the time, I didn't understand how much better they were than me.
Or where they stood in the hierarchy.
Yes.
Or, like, you know.
I didn't know, like, oh, that's how funny, you know, Keith Robinson is.
Oh, yeah.
And I should, I should be nervous around him because he kills every single night.
Yeah.
And all those guys, you know, Greer Barnes and...
Wow,
you know,
Greer Barnes.
You know, all these people, like, were so funny. And then I would slowly watch them. But at the very beginning, I just hadn't watched comedy in a long time. So when I would go in and I would sit at the table with all the comics, I didn't even know their acts to know who I was sitting with most of the time.
Right.
And then by the time I figured out who everyone was, I had enough of my sea legs to not be too embarrassed. But I was embarrassed. Like, oh, this is kind of weird that I'm attempting to do it. But I always felt like everyone realized that I love it so much.
But you were a comic.
Yes.
I mean, that's the weird thing is, like, I would have thought that, you know, sitting down with them, that you would have thought that they were projecting, like, what does this guy need to do this for? Why is he here?
I didn't get that from people.
Well, then I hit it well.
Yeah. I mean, oh, yeah. But you know what? Maybe that was what people were thinking. Just what is happening right now? Every once in a while, I would see someone get quiet. You know, I'd sit at the comedian's table, just someone very chatty would just stop talking. And I thought, God, I hope my presence here isn't making people self-conscious. Right. But then slowly...
You don't want them walking, you know, going home at 2:30 going like, I fucked up with Appetite.
Which is not why I'm there at all.
Right.
But everyone was so nice. I really fell in love with everyone there. And, you know, Esty and Noam, they just were very inviting. The club was excited to have me work there. And then... I worked my ass off. I wrote, you know, a ton of jokes to try to... I tried to be worthy of it. I really respected all the comedians and thought, I got to get good enough that I could think, I'm on the same level of these people.
But, like, I was watching the special and you were just... It was all loaded up with, like, little one-line pieces that I never heard before. And I didn't get it all the way to the end. Did you do the Cosby bit?
I do, yeah, near the end.
Like, and like that, I love that bit and I love all the kids stuff. I mean, and to sort of admit... Like, and you sort of had to, because you weren't going to go up and just do, you know, detached jokes.
Yes.
But you do, you know, you present your life as it is.
Yes.
You know, I am a rich producer of film and television. I live a very, you know, gilded life. Is that the word?
Yes.
But, you know, problems remain.
Well, that is the one thing that you notice, and I'm sure from your new perch and your new home, you will notice as well that once you can pay your bills, and I always say this, that, you know, people who have succeeded at what they've tried to do and who have a little money, they spend their whole lives thinking when this happens, then happiness will arrive, and then when it happens, you realize, oh, I'm still unhappy, it's me.
Well,
it's
yeah,
all me.
But I don't know that I ever thought that happiness would arrive. But I do feel there's some things I don't have to worry about like I used to. That used to consume me.
Yes.
But I mean, but when you really think about how is that going to change you to have? But I don't know. You know, I am getting a new house and I walk around it and I'm like, it feels different. Like, but you know, I'm 54. Yeah. I better do something to feel like that I've arrived somewhere.
It's hard to think that. You deserve it, you know, that you've worked a long time and I'm allowed to have the room, you know, with the big TV.
Yeah.
And I'm going to work hard on the sound.
Yeah.
Like, but you do think I don't deserve this. There is that, you know, fraud.
Why is that? I don't fucking know why that is. I mean, I feel that a little bit, but I guess for me, it's more like, you know, like, do I need it? It's not like deserve. It's sort of like, you know, I'm okay here, but this house is falling the fuck apart and I've not even fixed anything. And like when I empty it, it's going to be like they should just demo it.
Like, well, there's a point of pride in not being an asshole in the nice house.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult thing. I don't think I use much of it in the special, but I do talk a lot about people who always want more. Like if you're the Koch brothers and you have $35 billion and you are obsessed with getting all of these congressmen to push for a tax cut so you could make $2 billion more, of which you'll never spend a penny, what is going on in your mind? What are your values?
At the cost of people's lives.
Yes.
Quality of life, the country, the globe.
At food stamps. Could we get rid of food stamps so I can get a tax cut? And I think that is what's driving all of us mad, is that Trump is a symbolic of very wealthy people and it's not enough.
Yeah.
And as someone who, you know, doesn't have to feel terrible if I get a parking ticket, I don't get it at all, because other than sending my kids to school and having a place to live, there's nothing to spend money on.
Right.
All you really spend money on generally is you might go on a vacation,
yeah,
and you might get the extra appetizer, and that's about it. Like, why do you need, like, why does Trump need to say I'm worth $10 billion? If he was worth $900 million, it's...
Yeah.
What the fuck is the difference?
Well, he also has mental problems, and he needs, yes, to win, and he's a bully, and there's...
Yeah.
And he seems to be at the beginning stages of some degenerative mental condition.
Do you think that's it? People are beginning to say that openly, like something's happening.
Well, apparently his father had it, and his sister has it now, is completely incapacitated with degenerative mental illness.
Reagan, ran the country for several years.
Yeah, just push him out there.
Remember those Iran-Contra interviews he did?
Uh-uh.
He had to do a deposition.
Yeah. Not good.
It wasn't the best shining moment on a hill.
Well, so the special looked good. How many did you shoot? 9?
I shot 2 shows a night for 2 nights.
Okay.
I shot 4 shows.
Yeah.
The night before the first show in the same theater, I did a warm-up show to get used to the space.
So you did 5.
Yeah, and I didn't tape that one, and it went so badly.
Okay, and, good.
And people told me that would happen, but when it happens, when you run the full set...
And you just can't get over the hump? You can't...
It felt like every joke was starting over.
Yeah, the worst.
And some jokes would work, but every joke... And it was like... Canadian people who were so polite that they just, their energy never lifted.
But no, but I thought the thing, it looked great. Who directed it?
It was Marcus Ramboy.
Is he one of your guys?
He is just a great comedy director who did Pete Holmes special, and he does a lot of them. And I thought, I don't know how to do this. And he did a beautiful job.
Yeah, the suit was nice.
The suit was nice.
Who makes that suit?
I don't know, but professionals were involved. It's my punch drunk love suit.
No, but you look good in a suit. Like, I could never, like, I don't think I could pull a suit off. I think my head's too large. I don't know. I haven't worn a suit in a long time.
I look okay in a suit. I look a little bit like an agent, but my body is so wrongly shaped. It's just, I get a little pear shaped.
Uh-huh.
So I decided a few years ago. And my wife is not thrilled about this.
Yeah.
That the only shirt I looked good in was a black James Purse polo shirt. I bought 25 of them.
Oh, I see you in that a lot. Yeah.
And I just decided I'm not even going to pretend I look good in other clothes.
You did wear that a lot.
And then I lost some weight so I'd look okay
for the
special. And then
the
second we were done taping, just put another 10 back on.
Did you?
Yeah, just
start eating again.
And I just toss it all out the window.
I got my cholesterol down without statins.
There's a big fight in my house. My wife is against the statins.
I know. I got against them too, because I don't know really why, but no one wants to be on medicine. But I just cut meat and dairy out totally.
That's what people say. It's all the meat.
Yeah.
That people think it's everything else, but your cholesterol is very meat driven. I hate any discussion of having to be healthy.
Yeah.
I don't like that I have to do it.
Well, now it's like there's less reason, because it doesn't seem like things are going to go well. There's not a positive closure ahead. So you might as well live a little.
Sometimes when like I'm watching the news and they say, hey, Trump decided to put all the nukes on B-1 bombers to like be up in the air 24 hours a day. Yeah. I will eat that pint of ice cream.
Sure.
And I'm kind of happy that the window got smaller.
Yeah. No, I think that, sadly, it's true. Like,
right?
When old people like who I respect die, I'm like, they got out.
They got out.
Yeah. I'm like, thank God they didn't have to see this shit. After what they lived through.
Yes.
Like, let them go now.
As I get older and I feel closer to death,
mm-hmm.
I get a feeling like where I'm excited to die.
Yeah.
To just get out before like the environment falls apart, before some other bad thing happens.
I don't
know
if we're going to make it, dude. We might be around for it.
God damn it.
I know. What the fuck? We really thought I was going to get out before the world ended, but I don't know.
It used to be, when I was a kid, I would think they're going to cure cancer before I get it.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, they're not going to.
They've done real good with some of them. Really depends which one you get.
And I can't slip out mm-hmm. before the really bad stuff happens.
Yeah.
It becomes harder to create silly comedy in the face of this.
It becomes harder to do anything.
Yeah.
That is pleasurable or not. Or not requiring, because there's part of you that thinks like we're in an urgent situation,
yes.
and I should be doing something urgently, but you run out of there. What? So then, yeah. like with that kind of percolating and the news percolating, when you just want to go like watch a movie or enjoy something or play some guitar, there's part of you that's sort of like, why do this even?
Exactly.
Why not just sit?
Like I remember, you know, being home,
yeah.
and you know, kicking. You know, jokes around with Seth and Evan for Pineapple Express.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it'd be funny if he tries to kick out the windshield of the car
yeah.
and his foot just gets stuck. And then we would, you know, when they like pitched it, we would just giggle for 15 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know if that kind of moment is possible right now where you're so lost in the silly fantasy land. I was talking to someone about this for hours last night that, as a Jew,
yeah.
I feel like we're supposed to pay attention right now. And
yeah.
I'm not even religious, but I have a feeling of like my whole life I thought, why didn't they do something about all this, you know, during World War II?
Yeah.
And it feels like if I shut it all off and write silly jokes, I'm abdicating some responsibility. And then my friend was saying, no, the way you change the world is through your art. And that teaches people about love and connection and compassion. And everything you do to protest everything that's going on doesn't matter at all or anywhere near as much as the messages you slyly send through your comedy or your movies.
And how that sit with you?
You know what I think of? Yeah. I just think of trains of Jews going into camps.
Yeah.
And I just think, aren't I supposed to be like on the train tracks stopping it?
Yeah.
And I think... Is that just a nice notion that I'll write a movie now that comes out in 3.5 years, but how did that help people in Puerto Rico who have no water?
Right.
And aren't we supposed to...
Well, the thing is, would you be able to do the type of grunt work necessary to get your hands dirty and help out in a practical way, in an immediate yeah. way?
Well, the immediate way I do it is I just try to raise money.
Good.
Right, so I do, you know, I do an enormous amount of... benefits.
What is the ACLU thing? I got an invitation. Should I go?
Yeah, I'm going to get some sort of a recognition from the ACLU. As soon as the Trump thing hit, I said, I got to figure out what to do so I don't go crazy. One of the main things is I'm going to raise money for the ACLU.
Yeah.
Because so much of what slows Trump down.
I immediately sent them money.
Yeah. Just, okay. You need lawyers. And a lot of what has stopped the terrible things he's done, the transgender ban in the military or travel bans, is because the ACLU is suing them.
Right.
So, and then I think, well, I still get to do comedy.
Yeah.
I could strong arm friends into doing shows, and at least it's doing something. So that's one thing I try to do.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's right. Because I think that, you know, on the other side where people are just thrilled at, you know, I realize that what's happened because of a tone of an email I got is that these people that had that hated Obama, that hated culturally progressive movements in all areas, just became, they were enraged, and then they became exhausted by being forced to tolerate things.
Yeah.
And then once they didn't have to anymore, the fury just came out, the fury of intolerance. So now their condescending position is like, well, now you guys have to tolerate, you know, this horrendous intolerance and hostility and racism and hate. We had to put up with you guys
with
making
love, with love
and open-hearted shit, open-minded garbage. Now that, you know, so like for me, like I think what we have to do as a service to ourselves, but also to the country, is not fall into despair and let that become like just like it's. I think that authoritarian regimes, you know, feed on hopelessness, despair, and the reality that people are not really able to do anything about it.
Yeah, and we're so confused at how much we're lied to. You know, for instance, people already have forgotten about the Vegas shooting.
Yeah.
We're 5 insane things past that already.
And that was just weeks ago.
Yeah.
Everything, like, there's something about, there's an old Hicks joke. You remember the joke he did? I'm just paraphrasing it about watching the TV. It's like death, destruction, war, right? And then, you know, you open the door, it's like crickets. Like there's some
profound idea about, you know, what you allow into your head, what you allow it to do, and what your reality is and what you can do.
So the question becomes, can I stay positive? Can I think of constructive things to do while, you know, putting up my resistance and writing boner jokes?
Yeah.
Simultaneously.
Sure. No, the boner jokes are important, because if there's no humor, then there's just the hopelessness. And yes. Then, you know, but yeah. But let's talk about, before we go, like, I watched a rough cut of the Gary Shandling doc, and it's a beautiful,
right.
A beautiful thing.
You're one of the few people who've seen it.
Yeah, it was very touching. I loved it. And like I said to you, and I think I've told you before, and you knew him well, and you put this stuff together from archive footage, from his notebooks, from all the things you had access to in his life. And it's a, you know, it's a beautiful kind of memorial of a friend and mentor. But like that memorial service that I went to, the show, what would you call that? A memorial?
Yeah, we did a memorial for Gary at the Wilshire Ebell.
Right.
And a lot of people spoke. And I cut together little documentary sequences about different parts of Gary's life.
But just learning about him changed my life. Because I talked to him, and I don't know that I appreciated his comedy with the depth necessary, with the depth that was there, that it deserved. Mm-hmm. And also his process. And, you know, you turning me on to him, and then having me go to that thing, and then we did the green room together, and I got to, you know, sort of, I always liked him, but I never knew on some weird level how much I had in common with him.
Yeah, I think that's
emotionally.
I think that's what most people are realizing, is that they didn't know him as well as they wished they did.
Yeah.
Although people don't really have the courage to dig. You know, if like, you're in a unique position because you do get the moment with someone where you're allowed to ask the questions people will not ask in conversation.
Yeah, sometimes I can do it.
Yes. Every once in a while, you could just, you know, turn to someone like Gary Shandling and go, "Why are you like this?"
Yeah.
And get answers. But in life, even as his close friend,
yeah,
I wouldn't often dig for the psychological underpinnings of who he was. But when I made the documentary and I started figuring out how he became this guy and what he was doing and what he was attempting throughout his life to be sane and to find happiness and peace, I realized that it's very powerful. I related to it as well. And it's sad that people didn't get to share that with him as much as they could have while he was alive, because he had a very interesting journey, which is the same as us, which is we're young, we have some difficult childhood situation.
Yeah.
Comedy becomes some way to escape, a way to be seen. Then we want to be successful so that we feel good about ourselves, so that at some point we realize, oh, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
What does work, which ultimately is love and connection and some higher purpose. And then we go for that, which is still difficult and you know, very hard to attain. And then we get killed in that North Korea bomb.
No.
Right as we're about to feel that peace.
Yeah, finally.
But Gary had a fascinating, you know, story. I mean, the one that I love is that when he's 20 years old, he went to a comedy, not a comedy club, just a like a bar club.
Yeah.
And saw George Carlin.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And George Carlin is, you know, he's pretty new to being hippie George Carlin.
Yeah.
Gary writes bits for him.
Yeah.
I found the bits. He wrote a fake commercial for legalized marijuana.
Right.
So he literally wrote the bit. What if they legalized marijuana? What would the commercial be? And so he had about 5 pages of bits for Carlin. He walks up to him and says, "Hey, I wrote you some jokes." Just ballsy for 20.
Yeah.
And Carlin says, "I don't usually buy jokes, but I'll read them if you want to come back tomorrow. I'll tell you what I thought." Gary comes back the next day. They're laid out on the table with, like, he wrote on them. He made notations. And he says to young Gary, "You know what? I don't buy jokes, but there's one great joke on every page. And I think if you want to pursue this, you should." And Gary got in the car and just moved to California. And it changed his life.
Yeah, yeah.
He needed that.
And, you know, who knows if Carlin would have done that on any other day? Because you know what that's like, right? You know, who is this kid? It's a mood thing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know Carlin for, you know, how often he did that, but he was probably in Arizona. What did he have to do?
Yes.
Right?
Like, you know what I mean? And this little ballsy Jewish kid is like, I got these jokes. And he's like, I got nothing to do tomorrow.
I'm going to read these jokes instead of going to the mall.
Right. Yeah, something. Yeah.
And but I think Carlin used to do that. I heard his daughter, Kelly Carlin, on the show. And she said he would bump into a comic. He would ask the comic for his number. And then 8 months later, he would just call the guy and go, how are you doing? How's the career going?
Yeah.
And he would follow up in a really beautiful way with people. He knew that power that he had. And then I found this letter, and this isn't in the documentary, where 10 years later or 7 years later, Gary's doing like Make Me Laugh. You know, he's just beginning to get spots at the Comedy Store. And he writes a letter to Carlin thanking him for telling him to be a comedian. And he says, more important than your comedy is the man you are, and how he wants to be a man like George Carlin,
right?
Who speaks his truth, and it's wild. And I don't know if he sent it because I found it. It looked like the unsent thank you letter.
Wow.
But it was beautiful. It really. And he was like, I wrote an episode of Welcome Back, Kotter. Like that was going to impress George Carlin.
Maybe that's why the second thoughts came in. Yes. I'm not going to send this.
But that's going to be on in March.
Great.
And it's 4 hours. And I thought, you know what? If OJ's worth 7, Gary's got to be worth 4.
All right, buddy. Well, the special's great. It's called The Return.
December 12th on Netflix. Yeah, so
this is going to be, this isn't going to go up for a while because we're going to hold it until we promote the thing.
Yes.
So like, who knows?
The world could be so different when this runs in 3 or 4 weeks. Ivanka could be in prison by then.
Who knows what? That's upbeat. That's an optimistic.
That's the best case scenario.
Okay, again, Judd Apatow, The Return, premieres tomorrow, December 12th on Netflix, and it's good. He's been a latent stand-up comic for a decade or so. It's good to have him out, have him back. I did stand-up the other night at the Comedy Store, and I was third up in the original room, 10:45 spot, second show, and I got on stage. And I'd just been free-forming, doing the riffage, trying to find the beats, trying to find the path. Where's this going to go? What's this idea? How does it work? Does it have legs? But I've just been kind of having fun, riffing, trying not to freak out or freaking out in a funny way. And I get on stage and there's a guy front row, stage left, totally asleep. Totally asleep. And I'm talking, I'm on the mic, and you can hear it, it's loud, and I'm talking about him being asleep, and I'm asking him if he's awake, if he's enjoying his nap. Nothing, he's not waking up. I took a picture of the dude on stage, from the stage, and yeah, obviously I was, you know, having fun, and then the flash apparently woke him up, and I gotta be honest with you, I felt bad I woke him up. I felt bad, it was rude that he was sleeping, but it was one of those moments where I'm like, I should have just let that guy sleep. You know what I mean? I don't know his life. You know, he's in a safe place. He's in a comedy club. He came for a few laughs. Maybe he hasn't slept in days and he was hoping that the comedy would make him feel better. And he just finally got a little shut eye. He did, I think, end up going back to sleep. So Loudon Wainwright, he's a very prolific folk singer. And his memoir, Liner Notes, came out in the fall and is available wherever you get books. So this is me and Loudon chatting. You do the boats?
I have a sailboat.
So you know how to sail?
I know how to sail, yeah. I mean, I started when I was 55, so I kind of know how to sail. I've been doing it for 15 years.
Oh, it wasn't something you grew up with?
No.
God, it's like, I got a friend who sailed around the world. Are you that proficient?
No. No, I once did a long sail for 5 days, and that cured me of that.
So you can sleep in the boat?
I have. There is a place to sleep on the boat. I've never slept there. I had sex there once, but actually didn't sleep.
Oh yeah. Was that? Were you moving? Were you out on the water? Or just, was it just
the
docked?
Anchor was dropped, as they say?
Yeah,
we were anchored.
Yeah. Well, that was good. Was that something that you needed to get out of your system, or is that like let's fuck on a boat? It's time to fuck on a boat. Haven't done that. Let's do that. I don't know how much time I got left.
Well, you know, you have a boat and there's a place to lie down. Sure. It's actually a toilet, a head they call it.
Yeah.
And I've used that, but I said, well, so we said we should at least have sex on the boat.
This is what your wife.
This is my much better half.
Yeah.
My girlfriend.
Oh, there's a girlfriend?
Yeah, I got a girlfriend.
The girlfriend is this the mother of the last child?
No, this is somebody new.
Oh, it's a new one.
This is somebody who works at the New Yorker. In fact, I listened to your show with David Remnick, which I greatly enjoyed. But this is Susan Morrison.
Okay.
Who's a big editor at the New Yorker.
Oh, that's great. So that's nice. So you have someone to
have sex on a boat with
and have high-minded conversations about things. Well, so tonight you flew in today. You're gonna go do a thing with Christopher Guest tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys know each other a long time?
About 45 years, yeah.
Where did that start? I've talked to McKean, you know, and you're friends with him too?
I went to college with McKean, so that's how I met Chris, actually.
And Landers too?
David Lander. Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, acting school. So we're all studying to be actors.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And then Michael and David got kicked out, and Michael went to NYU, and that's where he met Chris in the acting program.
Uh-huh.
So when I came to New York, I met Chris through Michael.
Oh, so they were like youngsters. Like,
they met in college. That whole thing started in college.
Yeah, like what years are we talking there? Like that would be what?
67?
Yeah, so you were playing a bit or you weren't playing?
I was beginning to play. I had played guitar and began to write in 68.
Uh-huh. So the original idea was to be an actor.
That was the original plan.
Well, that's right, cuz in the book you talk about that feeling. That feeling of making people laugh on stage and just sort of like, this is it.
Yeah.
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 So that was really, you just knew you wanted to be on stage, connecting.
It started when I was in Santa Ana, when I was about seven, I sang a song a cappella for my mother and her twin sister and these two beautiful, they were, you know, 27 or whatever they were, beaming down this love and approval on me and that. That clinched the deal for me. I knew
that
I
did it.
I pretty. That's, you know, I'd wanted to be a cowboy and an astronaut, but then I wanted to be a performer after they.
But yeah, your mom had a twin sister. So where did you? I guess we should go all the way back because it's sort of interesting to me because you grew up in these kind of like two worlds in terms of who your parents were.
Yes.
Because you have very kind of like there's a fairly. High, you know,
highfalutin,
you know,
name.
Powerful bloodline, you know, of America in a way.
Yeah.
Legacy. Yeah, it's a big name, but your dad comes from a big family, right? From an old family.
Yeah, the Wainwrights have been around for years, and we're relatives with the Stuyvesants, you know, Peter Stuyvesant, the one-legged governor.
Yeah.
So my dad grew up as a kind of in the what they call the Gold Coast of Long Island. You know.
So the Stuyvesants, so that money or that family connection goes back to like pre-America New York to Dutch New York? Does it go that?
Yeah, Peter Stuyvesant was the first governor of New Amsterdam.
Uh-huh. Right, so, right. Okay.
So.
Way back.
Way back.
Yeah, they had those, like that. I never understand how that money stays around. Do you?
I don't know anything about money. I'm really.
I know you're a musician. But you grew up, you know, in that world, right?
Westchester, New York. You know, in the
country clubs, mansions.
We were the members of the. We were members of the Bedford Golf and Tennis Club.
Uh huh.
And but my dad met my mother. My mother was from the opposite end of the social scale. She was this funky white trash chick from Tifton, Georgia.
Uh huh.
You know, real, really dirt poor. Her dad was an itinerant tobacco farmer.
Uh huh. And she had she talked like that?
Loudy.
Yeah.
Loudy. That's so beautiful, Loudy. Sing that again.
That's sweet. I'm glad you had that, though.
Yeah, no. She was my biggest supporter, you know, when I was trying to start out singing and playing and stuff.
Well, there's a lot of kids, though. There's what, four of you or three of you?
I have four and a half siblings. My dad had a daughter late in his life.
God, you guys are, you know, just on you on the same life plan?
Just go out there and fool around and see what happens.
That's it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how old's that one?
That is Anna, and Anna is 33.
That's your half-sister?
That's my half-sister, Anna.
That's wild, huh?
Yeah.
When did you start, like, you know, what, because, like, I listen to a lot of the music, and, you know, you write very well and in the book, and there's something about, and you seem like a pleasant man.
It's early. I had a nap.
But, I mean, there's something about, like, because I do comedy, and I do very, you know, personal comedy. Uh-huh. And it seems that you are sort of compelled to be as personal as possible as well.
Yes.
And it seems that, you know, in my own life, and I imagine in yours, that, you know, there's a price to pay for that.
Some rough Thanksgiving dinners with the family.
But when, how does that, we can evolve into that, but when did you start, you know, writing songs, and what drove you initially?
Well, I learned how to play the guitar, and I had a guitar when I was 13, and I never thought I'd write songs. My dad was a writer, and writing, you know, observing him be a writer.
But he was like a journalist.
He was
right?
A journalist. He was a famous journalist. He had a column in Life magazine for years, and he was very well known in the 60s when I was growing up.
So I guess that's some, you know, you had to look up to that. You knew that your dad was famous, right?
I looked up to it, but I also looked askance at it because I didn't want to be like him, like most snotty-nosed kids. You don't want to be like your parents.
Uh-huh.
And second of all, he seemed to be an unhappy person trying to write and meet deadlines and write books.
But was he unhappy in general or...
He was unhappy in general. Yeah, he had a hard-ass father, Loudon Wainwright the First.
Yeah,
who died when my dad was only 17.
Uh huh.
And he never got to, you know, work any of their stuff out. So I think he was a
hard-ass how?
Well, I never met him, but you know, get your elbows off the table and just a disciplinarian. Mm-hmm. and you know,
not emotional.
Not yeah, cold.
Other than angry.
Cold.
Angry cold. Or cold?
I've seen pictures of him, and yeah. In fact, there's a picture of him in the book. You can see that he's holding it in and not letting any.
Well, what I thought was interesting in the book is that in the parts I read was that, you know, and I try to track this in my own life, is that, you know, you have enough self-awareness, you've done enough research on yourself, and there is to the degree that you have, but there's this legacy, you know, there are these generations of either emotional detachment or coldness that, you know, you're up against, whether it's conditioned or genetic, mm-hmm. that you're propelled by these things.
Yeah, the deck is stacked genetically.
However
it goes. The beat goes on, you know, there is a legacy of depression and self-loathing.
But your dad seemed like, your dad was not, I mean, it seemed like you had a relationship with him.
We, you know, it kind of toward the end of his life, he died, he was only 63 when he died.
Yeah.
So we kind of got a little closer toward the end, particularly after he got sick.
Yeah.
And in 1982, which was 5 years or 6 years before he died, he and I took a trip to Australia together. I was playing there, and they threw in an extra plane ticket. My dad came with me. We were both guys then. We both had broken families and were in new relationships.
Yeah.
Anna had just been born, so he was a new dad. He was a 59-year-old new dad.
That's wild, though. That must have been bizarre. Yeah. So you're on a level playing field almost.
Yeah. We really had probably the best time we ever had then.
Yeah.
You know, kind of toward the end.
Yeah, because you do talk about a moment in the book where you finally give it to him a little bit.
I gave it to him at the very end when he was in the hospital actually dying. And he, you know, so he's hooked up to tubes and bags and, you know, and I've always had this thing where, you know, my name is Loudon Wainwright the Third, which is a kind of a pretentious, it's my actual name.
Yeah.
But so he said when my career started, he said, well, you should use the Third because we don't want to have any confusion about which Loudon is which.
Right.
So I agreed to that.
Yeah.
But then I realized soon after that that he didn't use Junior.
Yeah.
So I said, And then I waited 20 years. But yeah. Finally, he's dying. I said, you know, Dad, I just got to say something. The Roman numeral thing, and you did not use the junior thing. So you were just plain old Loudon Wainwright.
Yeah.
And then he said, you can have the name when I'm dead. Which shut me up pretty good.
There's that poetry. See, yeah. The poetry, that goes right through it too.
Yeah.
So what were your choices? Like, I you know, you chose to be a musician, and you went to these private schools, which must have been a nightmare. But when did you choose? Like, how was the culture changing that made you want to do it?
Well, I went to Carnegie, which is where I met McKean.
But it must happen before, right?
Well, the playing was, but I didn't think I was going to be an actual musician, although I played in folk bands in boarding school and thing. But I dropped out of college. I was a hippie in San Francisco for about 2 years. I got busted in 67 in Oklahoma.
You were a hippie in like the late, in which years?
I was there in the Summer of Love. Donald Fagen and I lived in a crash pad along with some other people.
Did you meet him in San Francisco?
Yeah.
Fagen?
That's where I met him. I had met him earlier. My girlfriend at that time had friends at Bard. So yeah. He was at Bard, and that summer they went out to.
It's so weird. Like I know that he's like a great musician and a funny guy and a cynical writer, but I never locked into the Steely Dan thing.
Really?
Well, I mean, I can listen to it. I know the good songs.
Uh-huh.
You know, but like in terms of like complete nerding out, which it seems like they're a band where there's just people who are full on
yeah.
Steely Dan nerds.
I am a huge Steely Dan fan.
Sure.
In fact, once I asked Donald, because I kind of know him, and I know his wife, Libby Titus, and I asked him if he would produce one of my records for me.
Yeah.
He said no. kind of crushed me. So, but I'm a huge fan. I love those records. But I know that a lot of people don't. You know,
I'm coming around. I know the ones I grew up with.
It's very controlled.
Yes,
maybe that's the problem.
Yeah, I do like things
nailed.
Messy.
It's nailed down.
Yeah, it's almost like sterilized.
I don't know. I find the great stuff, and there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
The songs are very sad. I mean, the writing and his as a vocalist. I think Fagen is one of the great singers.
No, I agree. So you guys kept in touch a little bit?
A bit. We see each other every once in a while.
Yeah.
I forgive him for not wanting to produce my record.
Well, you got Richard Thompson to do it. That's not nothing.
That's right.
All right, so the Summer of Love, like, what was that like? Were you a acid guy, drug guy?
Acid.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The good stuff. Owsley.
Yeah, it was pretty. We would drop acid in the morning and then just kind of wander around Golden Gate Park.
Ah.
Talk to the bison at the buffalo pen there. And,
yeah.
And, you know, saw free concerts with the Grateful Dead and the Big Brother and the whole
thing. Did you hang out with those guys at all?
No, because I was just a lowly, you know.
You weren't even a guy
no,
yet.
No, I wasn't a guy yet.
Yeah.
You know.
You were just one of the hippie masses.
Yeah, I was. You know, I would go to the Haight-Ashbury free clinic to get broken glass taken out of my foot. I mean, I was one of those guys.
Yeah,
because you're walking around on drugs with no shoes. A great idea in a major city.
But you were a kid, right? I mean, how old were you?
Well, 67. 20? I was, I wasn't a total kid. I was 21.
But you know, like, I guess when I talk to guys who, you know, come of age as musicians at that time, I mean, you were there with this, like, cataclysmic shift, two or three of them, really, in music, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you grew up, and it was the end of, you know, what would have been sort of big bandy, I would imagine, when you were a kid, and then rock and roll starts and happens.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, it just completely shifts. In the late 60s,
mm-hmm.
into folk and then whatever, you know, acid and speed yielded.
Right. Whatever the drugs that were being taken.
Right. But the Beatles, like, I mean, you were like a very impressionable person when that shit went down.
Yeah. No, I loved all the, you know, the Beatles and the Stones and, of course, Dylan. I mean, when I started to play the guitar and sing, the folk boom was happening.
Yeah.
Which didn't last very long, but...
It didn't really, did it?
It lasted about 2 years.
Yeah.
And the Newport Folk Festival was the grooviest thing, but then electric music, when Bob plugged in...
Right.
...reasserted its power. But that...
is that how you look at it? Like, it's like, you know, we had a good thing going, and then, you know, you had to bring electricity into it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it left a lot of folkies in the dust. I mean, I loved when Dylan went electric.
I thought
it was very powerful and exciting and great.
Because I read Dylan's book, you know, the strange autobiography.
The Chronicles.
Yeah, which was great. Like, I think some of the best stuff in it was his, you know, depiction of that scene.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, after, so I'm assuming you went to San Francisco, did your acid.
Right.
And did you run away or did you? From San Francisco, or
well, I was arrested in Oklahoma on my way back.
And for then, what?
For possession of marijuana.
Yeah,
and then I started to write songs.
Yeah,
and with an acoustic guitar, not with an electric guitar.
Right.
So and then I went and sang in these little hoots and open mic things and. Cambridge and in New York.
But did you have to do jail time?
I was in jail for five days and nights.
Just for weed.
Yeah, but they were very excited because they found out that my dad was the famous Life magazine writer. So they were talking about 10 years. In Oklahoma City, yeah.
But they wanted to, because of that, I thought they were going to give you a break. I thought it wasn't.
No, and then my dad, he was living in London then, and he had to take two long airplanes, you know, one to New York and then one down to Oklahoma City. And he got a lawyer, and he knew a judge in New York. And basically, he used his influence and money to get my ass out of jail.
And
it was about to get jumped on my ass.
Yeah.
Because I was in a tank with you know, it was a county jail in Oklahoma City.
Uh-huh.
At night, we would sleep with a roommate, but in the day it was, you know, 40 guys milling around.
Really? Yeah. So it was pretty kind of hard time for 5 days.
For a preppy kid from Northern Westchester, it scared the hell out of me. I still have nightmares about it.
Do you really?
Yeah.
So
I was cute.
Yeah.
I was really cute.
Yeah, I saw those album covers, album covers. Yeah, you're a looker, man.
Right.
Yeah. You weren't exuding alpha strength.
No, they were going to jump on me. So my dad got me out, and that kind of straightened me up, and then I started into music.
So you say you were doing hoots? Is that what they were called?
Hoots, open nights. You know, you'd go and play three songs for a lot of other singer-songwriters and some Japanese tourists.
But you were going up to Cambridge, and you were in New York? You went back to New York?
Back and forth. I went back and forth to Cambridge and between Cambridge and New York.
So that was the folk scene, Cambridge
and
New York.
That was the folk scene. And then...
Because I know you talk about seeing Phil Von Ronk and those guys, and like, was this the heart of it, or were you...
The big folk stuff had gone.
Right.
You know, Dylan had gone electric, so the early Bleecker Street, McDougal Street, you know, Dave Van Ronk.
Dave, right, yeah.
Phil Oakes, Dylan, Richard Farina, that was 5 years before my time, so the remnants of that was going on when I hit the village.
Who was the remnants?
Well, you know, there was still Eric Anderson. I don't know if you know who he was. He was a good singer-songer. Uh-huh. He was a good singer-songer. Uh-huh. John Hammond Jr. was
I
around.
Love him.
Well, John Hammond Jr., I did a lot of shows with him at the Gaslight.
So you're doing that folk thing, and then, you know, how does the second wave of the folk thing, and what happens?
Well, what happens is I'm opening a show at the Village Gaslight on McDougal Street for John Hammond Jr.
Yeah.
And a guy called Brian Keating, who was writing for the Village Voice, wrote this ridiculously ecstatic review. Uh-huh. You know, this guy is the next guy.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what happens with comedians or musicians or actors. You know, they get pounced on if they're good.
Yeah. And when there was one or two papers that meant something,
right,
and there was no other input.
And within 6 months, I had a record deal at Atlantic Records. My struggle was so brief, it was ridiculous. I mean, I did not pay any dues.
But in that song on, I think it's History, the Bob Dylan riff, the Talking Blues structured song.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about that there was a sort of a big rush to sign Dylan types.
Yeah, because he was out of commission. For one thing, he had his motorcycle accident.
Right.
So male singer-songwriters were really, you know, they were signing them left and right.
So you said that it was you, Prine, Springsteen.
Yeah, I used to joke that we should start a new Bob Dylan club.
Sure.
And meet every year at Bruce's house. And
you should.
And have burgers.
He's got a nice house out there.
He's got a good house.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. Are you friends with him?
I have never met Bruce Springsteen. I've seen him play a couple of times, but I've never met him. I saw him way at the beginning of his career.
You guys are all workers, you know what I mean? I mean, that's the wild thing about the life you've led. And as a comic, I know that, you know, you go out there with your guitar and you're still out there with your guitar.
Yeah.
And ultimately, at whatever level you're doing that at, that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
Right?
No, that's the last chapter in my book, The 75 to 90. It's about the job of going and playing for 75 to 90 minutes. In my case, a lot of the time in clubs, you know, and I've been doing it for almost 50 years.
So, all right, so you get signed, you guys. Are you friends with Prine? I've talked to him.
I am friends with Prine.
It's great. You guys are like, you write very beautiful and clever songs with a little bite to them, a little humor, a little jab in the heart.
Were you a Steve Goodman fan?
I know about Steve. Like, you know, I don't, like, some of this music is familiar to me from my childhood, and I know about the couple of hits, but somebody sent me a lot of that stuff.
Yeah,
and
he
was
great. And he and Prine were kind of...
Yeah, they were buddies.
Yeah,
From the Chicago scene, right?
Right, right.
But so you get the record deal, and what was the expectation?
Well, they pretty much let me do what I wanted to do. That would be Atlantic Records. Nesli Erdogan signed me. So my first record is, I took 7 months to make, and it's totally voice and guitar. It's not
right. Loud and One.
Loud and One is just straight ahead, just the songs. Got great reviews, and nobody bought it. So then they came time for the second album, which interestingly enough was called Album 2.
Yeah, good thought on that. Good creativity
and
on the title.
Again, there was a harmonica on that, and I did a duet with my then wife, Kate McGarrigle. But the rest of the record is all voice and guitar and one song on the piano, and great reviews, and nobody bought that one.
Yeah.
So Atlantic dropped me. Columbia, Clive Davis signed me. And then I...
These are big guys. So it was Ahmet or the other, or his brother?
Well, Nesli signed me.
Right, okay.
And then Clive signed me to...
another big guy?
Columbia.
Yeah.
And then the Dead Skunk thing happened. They put me together with a rock band. Why are you laughing?
Yeah, I like the way you said it.
Well, yeah.
Was it not meant to be funny?
It was a thing. It was a thing. It was number one in Little Rock, Arkansas for 6 weeks.
There you go. Now you found your people.
Man.
Yeah.
I've always imagined Bill and Hillary kind of making out in a Rambler station wagon. The Dead Skunk on the radio.
Yeah. But that was a freak thing, right?
Well, it was freaking that it's been my only hit so far.
Uh-huh.
No, it was a big record. But then that problem was that then I was the skunk guy. So where's the next Funny Animal song? So then you have the problem of...
But was there pressure?
Yeah, there was. And I
from Clive and the brass?
But then the next thing I did was I made a record with Bob Johnston, you know, who produced Blonde on Blonde and Leonard Cohen's records and some of the great Dylan records in Nashville. We made a record in 4 days with all those guys, but it didn't have a Funny Animal song on it.
But that's sort of like, wasn't there a certain amount of like, because you're writing, you're doing, kind of soulful folk music, and you're writing, clever songs that tell a certain truth about the human condition. And now you got this skunk song, but you're still like, how did you not get angry and start drinking? And
I did. Don't worry, I did. I started to drink and philander, and my marriage broke up. And
this is the marriage to Kate?
Kate, yeah.
And that's Rufus's mom
that's
and Martha's mom.
Rufus and Martha's mom.
I've met them at different points in my life. So there you were. You know, the skunk song didn't repeat itself, and now you're just a guy, not selling records.
Well, I had a career not selling records, but I still, continue to work. And then Clive signed me again to Arista when he went to Arista. So in 78, I just stopped trying to... I was kind of half-heartedly trying to make what they called radio-friendly records.
Yeah.
You know, records that were somewhat produced.
Sure.
But then I started again and just started to put out, voice and guitar records. And I made those records with Richard Thompson, which were kind of stripped down. And
yeah.
So the production on the records served the songs. And I think generally, I've managed to do that for the last 30 something years.
Well, when you look back on it, like, you know, I noticed in the book that you talk about like philandering or the road or what have you, is, you know, and that you have done or tried to do, and what that did to your family. I mean, I'm just trying to put my finger on it, like, because, like, when you do these things in songs, you know, when you do songs, you know, about this kind of stuff, you know, right, about truth, about hitting your kid, about your relationship with your father or fathers in general, about, you know, whatever the darker songs you have, the more touching mm-hmm. songs, that, you know, that song is that 3 or 4 minutes, you know, but you still have this, you know, a life where you, I imagine, you know, you have a full range of emotions and mm-hmm. and you're a decent fella. But it's just interesting when you're defined by your music, because there, I don't know whether I read it or I'm just projecting it, that how close do you feel to the protagonists of your songs in general?
Well, I feel, I wouldn't pretend that it's, I feel close to, it's me, you know.
It is.
It's a kind of crystallized, polished, I mean, although it talks about some of my less appealing traits sometimes,
yeah, right,
but it is me. It's the waterfront that I've covered.
Uh-huh.
My life, my family, my kids, my parents, my sister. There's songs about all these people because these are the people that mean a lot to me, and they're quite particular. And I don't really write generic love songs. I admire people that can do that.
Yeah,
or even other people that have kind of cryptic things where you're not quite sure what they're writing about.
Right.
Like Dylan, or even Steely Dan for that matter.
Sure.
You're never quite sure what it's about.
Yeah.
But my tendency, and I don't know why, because it's just the way that I write. Everybody develops a style. But I write very straight ahead. It's very descriptive. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And a lot of it, I mean, I do write sometimes political songs and straight ahead novelty songs, but a lot of it is about my family and my life.
Well, which is interesting because it's like, you know, a lot of Prine songs are not, he makes characters.
Yeah. I don't do that much.
So that you're right. So those are the choices. Either you write cryptic songs that people can just, you know, kind of use as a template to feel whatever they're going to feel mm-hmm. without having any kind of, you know, not knowing what it means.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you have like songs about people you make up. And then there's guys who do the straight stuff. You're like the straight guy. You go right to the heart of it. You're doing the memoir song.
Yeah, 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 baby.
The real deal.
That's it. I'm the real deal. I'm the real damn deal.
But like when you're writing as a kid, you know, when you wrote, you know, Loud and One and stuff, you know, you must have had in your mind, you were judging yourself against, you know, Dylan or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, I gotta nail this thing.
Well, I had to figure out, like, again, like everybody else in show business, when you start, you've got to figure out what to look like and, you know, how to separate yourself from the pack.
How'd you do with that?
Well, I assumed that I took up the costume of my youth. I looked like, I had short hair. If you look at that first album, everybody else had long hair and bell-bottom pants.
Right.
I had kind of a Brooks Brother blazer and gray flannel pants.
Yeah.
And so right away, there was a different look.
Right.
And then I started to sing a lot about myself.
So you're preppy-ish.
Yeah, preppy psycho killer look.
Right, not Kingston Trio.
No. That would have, no. That's late 50s.
Right.
No.
But they were all pretty clean cut, seemed preppy-ish,
yeah,
right?
But
striped shirts, I think, as I recall.
Yeah, no, I would never wear a striped shirt. Don't tell them what I'm wearing today.
That's a nice plaid. I have a nice multicolored plaid.
Thank you.
It is striped. I thought there was, no, it's not a plaid, it's a striped shirt.
Fashion on the radio is great, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's not Kingston Trio style.
No.
That's a vertical
They were
stripe.
Short sleeve shirts, yeah, the Kingston Trio.
Oh, thank God.
And they all matched.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
That was the big mistake.
So, all right, so you're doing these records, the Skunk Song happens, you know, you have this relationship with the label, with Clive Davis, or what's happening around you in music at that point? What are you up against? Because, like, you've really, you know, kept going.
Yeah.
But and at different times, music is changing around you constantly. But you're locked into Americana music, one, you know, folk or you know, country-ish band.
I write the songs on an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
You know, usually record them with that, and it's the same 5 chords that I learned when I was 15. What happened was I just kept my head down and kept writing songs.
Right, but when did things get bad? Like, at what point did the family structure start to, the vessel start to kind of shake?
You know,
like, in terms of, you know, you put these records out, you're not selling records, you got to be on the road.
Mm-hmm.
You're building a following however right. you're doing it.
Right.
And at some point you said that you started drinking and that you did get bitter, and that made it into the music a bit, but yeah. it didn't seem to sink you.
No, I've had a pretty good time, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some, like anybody's life, there's collateral damage.
Sure.
You know, but it hasn't been bad for me.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't been severely depressed
right.
or had a nervous, when my mother died in 97, I kind of fell apart, but that was appropriate. Normal.
Sure. Natural.
So by and large, you know, I just kept my head down and did the job, and I liked playing, and that's still what I'm kind of doing.
How did your following evolve? How did you find that you got the people, the fan base? What did they come for, and how long have they been with you?
Well, a lot of them have been with me for the ride. I mean, and sometimes I'm shocked when I see my you know, I drive up to the club and I see these old people. I think they're there for the bingo.
Yeah, right.
I mean, but then it's dark and they're so beautiful and warm and they yeah. love me. But then other things happen, you know. We mentioned Judd. I mean, I did this, I was in this show that Judd Apatow did, Undeclared.
Yeah.
So as a result of something like that, all of a sudden there were young people there.
Uh-huh.
So, or fans of my son and Rufus and uh-huh. Martha or something. So you know, occasionally there's some young people up there.
Sure, but it must be wild, because, like, you know, have you had that experience where, I mean, how old are you? Do you mind me
71.
Asking? So you're 71, and you know you've had a good go at it.
Yeah.
you've lived your life. Do you have that moment where you go back to places and a woman comes up to you and goes, "Do you remember me?"
Yeah, that's happened, yes. And invariably, no, I don't. But I say, of course I do. And sure. my line is, through the mists of time, here we are. And no, that just happened to me, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like with somebody your age?
Yeah, somebody right. my age.
It's wild, right?
And a very nice person. And so I said hello and apologized, and we let it go at that.
You apologize.
I didn't apologize. She apologized.
Well, that's funny though, because like you're not like I guess like the assumption about how a performer lives on the road. You know, you're not some sort of crazy party dude. You know, you weren't like
not anymore. No.
Yeah, you're not some dangerous, weird, junkie or freak out there. You're a folk guy.
Right.
And you're out there getting laid just like anybody else.
Yeah.
But they must be. I'm just picturing just pleasant ladies.
By and large, they were very pleasant, as I recall. They were human beings.
Sure.
Because
they're not, they're responding to something very, yeah. you know.
But
pure.
I hasten to say, we're laughing about it, but it's important to point out, at least for me, is that a lot of it created a guilt and bad feelings and feeling like an idiot and a jerk and an abuser of power. You know, in terms of my domestic life, you know, I had the marriage with Kate, then I was with Susie Roach for 9 years, and we had a daughter. So those marriages were kind of smashed up because of my goofing around.
On the road.
A lot of it, yeah. Yeah.
But it wasn't like your dad. You weren't hiding like 7 year relationships necessarily.
I didn't do that, you know. I would hide like 2 week relationships. And
right.
again, a lot of times, we're talking about my proclivities a lot, but again, the nature of the job is you go to some town. It's not a relationship at all. It's you know, someone yeah. to go home with,
right?
So you don't have to face the television set.
But also, it's like it's surprising as somebody who.
Well, performed. Doesn't that happen in your world?
Sure,
it must.
Of course. You know, I mean, I ruined my first marriage like that. But I don't have I don't have children. I never did that. I don't feel terrible about it. But yeah, I mean, there's something profoundly lonely about a hotel room. I don't know what it is, but you know, when you're on the road, even if it's for a night, you're like, where am I?
And you've just made love to 300 or 3,000 people
who've
adored you.
Right. I guess I don't factor that in all the time.
Yeah,
like you've done a thing.
Right. And then you kind of take a hostage back to the hotel, a love hostage.
Yeah. And they're excited.
They are. They're into it. They're, yeah. You know.
But what? But you sing about this stuff, and it has there has been like kind of a tension that I mean Rufus came at you with a song, and I think Martha came at you with a song,
yeah.
And there's there was like, and I imagine why wouldn't they? You're their dad. You right. do it,
right?
I mean, you've been writing about them since they were infants.
Yeah. No, so, it's all if you got to take it if you're going to dish it out, and Rufus and Martha. Have certainly taken shots, and I can take it. I mean, sometimes it's Martha wrote this song. You can swear on your radio,
sure.
Okay, yeah. So bloody motherfucking
right.
asshole.
Yeah.
So for a while, when she used to open shows for me in the beginning of her career. So she would do this song, and I would think, boy. She was going out at the time with a singer called Dan Byrne. Uh-huh. I don't know if you know who he is. A really talented singer, a bit older than her.
Uh-huh.
And they had a tough, difficult relationship. So
yeah.
I thought, boy, that's a tough song about Dan, you bloody motherfucking asshole.
Yeah.
So then we're in Paramus, New Jersey, and Martha goes out. And it's my audience in the room, mm-hmm. primarily because her career is still moving up. So she announces to my audience that this is a song about my dad, and then sings Bloody Motherfucking Asshole. So that was a moment that I was...
Let's bring up
hello! Yes.
How was that when you got up on stage?
Well, I just made a joke.
Did
I can't
you?
Remember. Probably, yeah. I just got through it.
But why'd she just... So she decided to lay that on you, and you had no idea, and what happened after that show?
Martha's very provocative. I'm sure she would agree with that. She likes to push the envelope.
Sure.
I agree. I think that's a good thing to do. Performers need to wake people up, shake people up.
Even if it's her dad.
Even if it's their dad.
Before he goes on in front of his audience.
Yeah.
But it seemed like it was almost like a secret she was keeping for a while, because she was playing it.
Yeah.
And then at some point she decided, like, well, I can't let him think that it's not about him.
Right. No.
Yeah. But you never, there was never a point where you guys weren't talking to each other.
Oh, we've been there. We've been there. Are you kidding me? Let's see. Am I talking to Rufus this week? Now, I have another daughter who's an incredible musician that I want to talk about, Lucy Wainwright Roach, my daughter with Suzzy.
Yeah.
And she has.
From the Roaches, right?
Yeah. Well, Lucy has not written a song attacking me yet, and I really appreciate that.
Uh-huh.
But that's not her style anyway.
Yeah, but sometimes I think it's that first group.
Could
of
happen,
kids.
Though.
Sure. But I think it's the first group of kids that think they get the raw end of the stick the most.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In general?
Yeah.
But Rufus, like, is a spectacular performer and songwriter, and, his song about you, I guess, is what, Dinner at Eight?
Yeah.
And that's a sad song.
That's a beautiful song.
It is. It really is.
And it's sad. And,
yeah.
But I think it's a great song. It's one of his great songs.
Well, when you process this stuff, what do you think your best album is for you? What's the one that you're like, I really nailed it all the way through on that one?
Well, I've made 27 albums. I think some people, and I've made some duds, that's for sure, are albums that I don't really like.
Yeah.
I think there's an album called History that I made, and it was right after my dad died.
Yeah.
And that event was such a cataclysmic thing. These songs started to come out that I think they're some of my best songs.
Yeah, it's a great record.
Yeah.
It's a great record.
And then when my mother died, I made a record called Last Man on Earth, and a lot of that, unfortunately, I only have two parents.
Yeah.
But, those are two very strong records of mine.
Yeah. Yeah, history is like beautiful. And I think, didn't you do one of your father's songs on that?
Yes. My dad wrote a song. There was a guy that my dad lived, we lived in L.A. for a bit in the early 50s, and dad was a friend with Terry Gilkison, who was a folk singer, but a pop folk singer. He had a group that they sang backup on Dean Martin records, like Memories Are Made of This.
They were that weird Hawaiian bunch?
Well, they were. Well, it was folky,
Yeah.
They sang a song called The Wild Goose.
Well, that song, Memories, has a weird little uke. It's got a uke thing.
Yeah.
Going. Yeah, yeah.
But Terry Gilkison and my father were drinking buddies.
Uh-huh.
And I think that my dad took a shot at writing some songs, hanging out with him. And he wrote a great song about 1950, so he would have been 25, called Man Is Just a Handful of Dust. And that song is on History.
I guess I'm sort of fascinated at your self-awareness and about, because I wrestle with some of the same things you do. Now, is there redemption after this? When you say that you look back or in the moment or whatever wreckage you've wreaked on anybody, do you just have an acceptance around it that it eventually resolves itself if you don't make it worse? Or do you still kind of like, you just think you're propelled by that? Is there still guilt and, you know, self-hatred and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, but you know, there is redemption and forgiveness. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, my kids are, you know, my youngest daughter, whose name is Alexandra, she's 25. But, I mean, Rufus is 44 and Martha's 40 and Lucy's 35.
And they all have kids? Or
Rufus and Martha have kids. So, you know, but they're all grown-ups. They've been banged around in the world. And yeah. so there's some forgiveness floating around.
You're right.
And that's what I've, you know, one of the things I did in my book was I included some of my father's writing. He was a beautiful, elegant writer. Some of his essays are in the book. And I love he and I had a kind of a crappy relationship, but he died more than 25 years ago. So there's a forgiveness thing that's going on now between me and him, even though he's been dead. And if you can't forgive your parents, I'm talking to my kids now, if you can't forgive your parents, you can't forgive yourself. That's my theory at this point.
But you learn that the hard way.
You make a lot of mistakes, and I made plenty of mistakes. I mean, it wasn't any more than anybody else. Okay. I just wrote about it. Yeah. I had a couple of broken marriages, and I screwed around. I mean, that's it.
No, I know. I know. Like, I used that one, too. Like, in the sense that, you know, there is a short menu to transgression. You know, and there's, of course, there's a big range.
Yeah.
But, you know, certainly there are ones that sort of, there's nothing unusual.
I didn't drown any puppies.
No, right. Like, yeah. And you didn't, you know, bankrupt a country or kill anybody. Right.
Right.
Right. You know, you kind of like judge yourself on the moral transgression chart and how familiar it is culturally.
Yeah.
And you're like, look, you know, people fuck up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So please forgive me, kids. I'm saying this on the radio.
But you also, you seem to wrestle with the very idea of love.
Yeah, love, yeah.
Like, I do material that's similar to this. And I'm trying to, like, glean from you, because I'm a little younger than you, you know, how you resolve some of that stuff. I mean, like, because I feel like I'm capable of love.
Yeah.
You know, of giving, but there's something that holds me back.
Yeah.
And in terms of guilt and whatever, but like, how have you, I imagine having kids changes that.
Well, I have a song called All in the Family.
Yeah.
It's All in a Family. And that is about love, you know, love heals heartache and familial pain, and what family is not insane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so love has been working its way into the songs in the last 10 or 20 years.
You feel with age and grandkids?
Yeah, I think grandkids, yeah. You know, and you do realize that, you know, it's kind of corny, but the love thing is a big thing.
Do you ever feel pointlessness? Is that a theme?
Well, I mean, I wrote a song when I was 25 on my second album called The Suicide Song.
Yeah.
But,
it's a long time ago.
It was a long time ago, and I was kind of goofing around anyway.
Right.
I wasn't really. The worst I ever felt was after my mother died. I really went down hard on
that. How old were you?
50. I was.
Uh-huh. Oh, right.
I was 51 or something.
So you'd already gone through a lot of your stuff, too.
Yeah, a lot had happened to me, and my father had died earlier, and that was more of a release for me when he died. When my mother died, the bottom went out.
And what was the feeling? Just sort of like, you know, like a void.
Yeah, I couldn't get out of bed. You know, I mean, I've been mildly depressed for my entire adult life.
Sure,
but this was the real thing.
Yeah,
you know, I was really, but with time.
Yeah.
And seeing a shrink.
Yeah.
And some, you know, lorazepam, I got back on my feet.
Yeah. Oh, good, good. And you made. So I want to talk a little bit before we wrap it up. I know you got to do stuff. The acting and the sort of TV thing. I had no idea until I looked it up today that you were actually involved with the original David Letterman daytime show. Is that true?
Yeah, I was. the musician sidekick on the couch for the first week.
And that show didn't last that long? Is that what happened?
No, they did me for a week, and then they thought, this isn't great. And then they tried some other guests. And then they shifted over to Late Night and brought Paul Schaefer in, I guess.
And, like, what was some... Because you did act here and there. Like, I mean, how did that... Who was bringing you into that? Like, you knew the... Like, you knew Christopher Guest and McKean and those guys when they had the sketch of Spinal Tap, correct?
Yeah, I was in Spinal Tap.
In the movie?
In the sketch.
In the sketch.
It was in a Rob Reiner a TV special called The TV Show. Martin Mull was in it.
Uh-huh.
And Harry Shearer was in it.
Uh-huh.
And they came up with this sketch about a heavy metal band. I was the keyboard player.
Right.
You can see me on YouTube.
Oh, yeah?
In a wig, yeah.
Yeah. So you always sort of were, these were your close friends, so you were sort of, you know, in proximity to comedy all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
You're always kind of like around.
Yeah.
And when you met those guys, you went to college with some of them, but you met, you saw, like, in the city, like, you were there pre-SNL, right?
Yeah, when I met Chris when he was in this thing called Lemmings.
Oh, the National Lampoon Radio Hour.
Right,
thing?
Yeah. So that was pre, you know, Belushi and Chevy Chase, and this was 2 years before Saturday Night Live.
And you saw that perform live?
Yeah.
Where did they perform that? Like the
at the Village Vanguard.
Oh, really?
Which was on Bleecker Street.
Yeah, sure.
And it was great. It was amazing. It was incredible.
That was the dark festival, the rock festival.
Yeah,
that was the satirical answer to Woodstock.
That's right, where they all would just go off the edge of the cliff.
Right. So you saw Belushi as a young crazy.
Yeah, I think he did his Joe Cocker impression.
Right. Of course. Right. Of course.
And Chris did incredible Dylan and. Wonderful actress who's no longer alive. Alice Platon was in it. And
yeah.
Gary Goodrow and a lot of great, and Chevy, a lot of great people.
And you did SNL early on too, right?
I was in the first season. I was in the third show. Robert Klein was the host.
Yeah.
And the other musical act was ABBA.
Really?
And nobody knew who they were. They had just won the Eurovision Song Contest. And they were the only group, I'm told, that ever lip sank on Saturday Night Live.
That first time?
They did it then, and Lorne decided that would never happen again.
Was there chaos at the show? Was it everyone excited? Was there like I can't imagine that first season. Because it was more of a variety show, and there was they had short films and, you know, more singers.
No, it was great. It was, you know, with all the original cast.
Yeah.
I remember the party after the show we did.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody was talking about things
and
going off to the bathroom every once in a while.
Sure, yeah. What was that? Did you do Carson or any of those shows?
I did Carson twice, once with Johnny and once with Doc Severinsen.
Guest hosting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I did, you know, I've done, I did the Mike Douglas show. Are you old enough to remember that?
Sure. I used to watch it after school. They sit around the half circle, right?
Yeah. I did a lot of Mike Douglas shows.
Oh, yeah?
I did Merv Griffin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And
shows I have done.
Yeah. But sitting there with guys, to me, you know, I thinking back on those talents, you know, at that time, it just, everything seemed to be more like a community.
Yeah.
Everybody seemed to know each other. Am I making that up, or do you feel that too? Like, you sitting out there like on a Merv Griffin show, and there'd be some comic there and some other guy there. But yeah, show business felt small to me.
I think it was a little looser, maybe.
Uh huh.
You know, and I don't think that people were, but there were egos flying around and
sure
and crap and bullshit.
But, yeah, yeah.
But it was a long time ago.
How'd you do MASH? How'd that happen?
Larry Gelbart saw me playing at the Troubadour in L.A. in 73 or something, and said, hey, how about an idea of a singing surgeon? And I did 3 episodes of MASH.
that's fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
And then all of a sudden you got Judd, putting you in everything.
Judd has been incredible.
Yeah.
And,
what was the first thing he put you in?
Undeclared. Yeah. When he was a 14-year-old kid growing up in Syosset, Long Island, he saw me on that Letterman show.
Yeah.
Then he used to come into town and see me play at the Bottom Line.
When he was a kid?
Probably. Well, then he was like 18 or 19.
Oh, so he's been a fan a long time.
He's been a fan a long time.
Yeah.
And then I got this call about 12 years ago from And I had no idea who he was. I had not seen Freaks and Geeks. Uh-huh. It was weird. Today, I got on a plane from this morning in New York, and Martin Starr was sitting next to me.
He's a great guy.
About Judd and Freaks and Geeks. And all
Martin Starr is an intense dude. He's a good guy.
He slept most of the way. But I could tell he was intense.
Yeah. He's intense. Yeah. So he puts you on Undeclared, and then you know.
Yeah, and then, you know, I gave me some parts in some other movies, and then I wrote with Joe Henry, my friend Joe Henry. We wrote the music for Knocked Up, and good stuff from Judd.
Yeah, and you did that cover of another friend's song, right, Daughter?
Peter Blegvad, yes, great.
Who's
song.
That guy?
That guy is a really interesting guy. He's an expatriate. He's an American, but he's been living in London for almost 40 years. He was in a rock band in the 70s called Slap Happy.
Uh-huh.
And they played a lot in Europe. He's a great songwriter. He's also an amazing cartoonist and a writer. And hardly anybody knows.
It's a hell of a song.
That's a hell of a song. If you Google me, the first thing that comes up is Daughter.
Uh-huh.
So I have to always tell people that I didn't write that.
Yeah. Well,
it's a pain in the ass, but it's a great song.
At least the skunk thing's behind you.
Yeah, man. It used to be skunk. Now it's Daughter.
You can't get a fair shake on your good shit.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, it's great talking to you. The book is beautiful. It's well written. It's fun. And what happens now? Do you tour constantly?
I tour regularly, I'd say. Judd and Chris are talking about maybe getting together. I have this theater show called Surviving Twin, which is my songs mixed in with my dad's writing, and I've been doing that. And so there's some talk that we might do a film of that. So that's the next thing that hopefully will happen.
You really are emotionally burying the hatchet with your dad posthumously.
The more you forgive, the better you feel.
Yeah?
That's I just made that up just now. That's a bumper sticker, isn't it?
Or a song.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go back.
You get cracking on that.
Okay.
Thanks, Wadden.
Very nice talking to you.
Okay, that was that. The book, Liner Notes, is out. Get it. Get the book. It's good. A Life in Music, A Life in Entertainment. Loudon Wainwright. Dig it. Can you dig it? Guitar? Guitar, anyone?